Welcome to We Mentor Mondays podcast with Nancy. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery. Learn something new from our stories today. Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast program. Today in the studio, we have a second session here with Yvonne Ng, who founded the Engineers Playground, and Troy Pongratz, who's the founding partner of the collaborative lab 651. Yvonne is the founder and chief consultant of Engineers Playground. She's an engineering education specialist, consultant, and author who combines practical insights with creative approaches to training teachers and students and developing STEM curricula. In 2011, Yvonne founded Engineers Playground to help make engineering accessible to a wider audience by nurturing and developing the lively curiosity and hands-on abilities that make children natural engineers. Her goal is to help inspire future generations of engineers and scientists, particularly at the time when STEM skills are in high demand. And her husband, Troy Pongratz, leads the product design team at Lab 651. He's been involved in product design for over 20 years in industries such as medical, consumer, and industrial products. His work has yielded multiple patents. An experienced consultant with both large and small companies, Troy brings a team approach to designing products and integrating new products in multiple disciplines. Troy and his team consider it their personal responsibility to support a product design from beginning to end to ensure its success in the marketplace. And we learned in our first episode that there are many iterations of design. So you don't hit it out of the park the first time around.
That's very, very rare.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I usually, with our prototyping cycles, you know, we, you know, kind of do something we call, you know, a fast iterative technique. We try to prototype and get to prove our, you know, validate our assumptions as quickly as possible. And Instead of trying to think of everything that could possibly happen and spending a long time in that, I've found that it's more productive to kind of break it up into little bits. You know, it's kind of hard to prototype everything in one prototype. You prototype elements as quickly as you can, and you find out what works and find out what doesn't work. Mm. It usually takes like at least 3 rounds
Of
prototyping to get closer and closer to your final solution.
So you want to fail quickly.
Yes. You've heard that model before, but I really think it's true.
Yeah.
Prove it or discard it as quickly and inexpensively as you can.
Yeah. So, and we've learned in the first podcast that both of you are mechanical engineers, but each of you have a different bent. So Troy has more of a product design perspective.
Yes.
And Yvonne has more of a automation and computer science perspective.
It's a controls and systems perspective. I see
there we
a whole
go.
System, and I figure out how the technology can help make that run better. Usually my specialty is also working with the humans, because the humans usually interface with the technology. So I also often think about, like, what is it that a human would need to do their job better or to make it easier or to reduce errors or dangerous situations so that they would be aware of that.
Sure.
Or to make good decisions, because there's a lot of data out there.
Yeah.
And you can't always process numbers. There's different ways you have to process that. So part of it is to use the computer to help make that understandable to a person to do their job better.
Yeah. And what are you working on right now?
Well, I actually have a day job. And so the day job right now is being a business systems analyst or business analyst sometimes. In right now, banks. Actually, my told my husband the first time, he said, "A bank?" Because like, we usually are used to going to like engineering places or whatever. But when I had my baby, we decided that when I was going to go back
four years ago,
I could either go the engineering route, process engineering and automation engineering like I did before, or I could go this IT route, because having taught computer science and taught students who went into IT, it certainly was a field I could go into. At least I had the knowledge.
Sure.
And, we looked at it, and there were a couple of reasons why I decided to go the IT route. One was IT's management style and work expectations were much more flexible. If my son ever got sick, I could work from home.
Yeah.
And so that's a lot more accepted in the IT field than in the engineering field. There are a lot more IT jobs available just on the market. And then also, they were on the right side of town because all the engineering jobs are on the west side of town. And
oh,
I would have had
funny.
To cross 494 to get over to the west side of town. And
yeah.
if my son got sick, I'd have to cross all the way back again. And, you know, it was just a bad idea. And also,
I like your practical approach.
Yeah.
yeah.
And IT made more money. I mean, that's the thing my husband
says. There we go.
IT makes more money.
Really? All arrows yes. pointing in that direction.
Yeah. So that was sort of the decision to go that way. And so far it's worked out well. I always kept feeling I was betraying my engineering background. I'm like, but I'm really an engineer. And Troy goes, You're really a systems person, and the computer systems are getting complicated, and they need people who think like you. And he's like, and you're not really an engineer in the sense that you don't like to make greasy, crappy things and get all mucky. And I'm like, I could. He's like, no. You're much better at seeing the order and the chaos. Is that what you said?
I've seen Yvonne. She has a very, very unique skill. She can very, very quickly look at a very complex system and figure out what is connected to what, and if this string is pulled, you know what's going to happen. It's kind of like
engineering eye.
Well, it's different. It's not. Yeah. I mean, engineering, you know, follows equations and process. And Yvonne has this skill. Like, imagine a room with there's like little pieces of paper literally swirling around the room like a blizzard, and that blizzard is the system in anything, in a bank, controlling a machine, you name it.
Yeah.
And people, you know, normal people, I say, look at this swirly blizzard and they're overwhelmed. They're just like, they have no idea where to even begin. And somehow I've seen Yvonne, imagine this is just a story I like to say. I mean, she can she would run around the room and snag bits of flying paper and paste them all down on a page or two and say, this is how the system works. And it's not like every bit of paper is now pasted down, because that would take too much time. You know, she can get a system figured out in a couple of months. I remember at her first job at Wells Fargo, she was answering questions that people had after 2 months. And then they'd ask her, how long have you been here? And she's like, oh, a couple of months. And they're like, I've been here for 2 years and I don't know how that works. Yeah. So that's why when Yvonne says she's a system engineer, that's right. System engineer.
And is that must be where your curiosity lies? Kind of like you are curious to figure out how things work?
I guess so.
And how they're connected?
I guess so. I think, like Troy says, I like looking at things that are confusing. And I guess I have an optimistic belief that there must be some reason it's working the way it is.
Yeah.
And like Troy says, part of the key is not to try to find everything, but just to find the biggest things that are creating the most influence. And so, since you and I have that teaching background, my biggest challenge in developing my systems abilities was in teaching. How do I take a whole bunch of individual students, especially teaching them computer science and especially them being women, who come from a variety of backgrounds that have basically guaranteed that they will not go into computers, because they have not since 1987, where they had the high point of women going in. And how do I figure out a system that will, on the whole, get most of them not only to learn the material, but want to learn more.
Hmm.
And humans are one of the hardest systems to figure out, because they're so emotional, you know?
Right.
That's why the stock market's hard to predict, right? It doesn't always follow equations that tightly, but there is usually something underneath it that's very common. And when I can find those things and hit those hard and again, and I can get that resonance going, then we start to have things coming through. And so that was my biggest challenge. And so now when I work in the computer world, it's so easy, because computers are far more predictable than young college women. Or any guy can tell you that. They're far more predictable than young college women.
That's cute. So. We mentor. So where did you guys meet? How did you meet? You were in New Jersey at Princeton, and you were at Mankato, eventually at the U.
It was, we were both in Minneapolis.
I came here for graduate school.
Yeah.
No, oh, okay.
I think it was 1996, and it was in Tai Chi class.
Everyone thinks we met at work. Because we're both engineers, but we really met in Tai Chi class. And I had sworn off dating engineers since I was in college. I refused to date an engineer at all. One, because I was way too competitive. And if he wasn't better than me or as good as me, I would be really obnoxious. Yeah. And then if he was better than me, then he's usually pretty obnoxious back. And then I couldn't handle that. So it was just better not to date them at all.
Yeah.
But Troy started Tai Chi in 96, mm-hmm. and we were talking and did some Tai Chi lessons together because I was an instructor at the time. And then somehow he asked me what I did. And I said, oh, I'm an engineer, because I knew that was sort of a good ice maker rather than an ice breaker. And he said, oh, I am too. I'm like, no, you're not. No, I am.
No, please don't say that. I like you.
No. I did have another rule to not date students. So, We broke all those rules. I broke all the rules. But that was where we met. Yeah.
Yeah, and we were in class maybe 6 months. I was in class 6 months. And then, I don't know, it was going to class, learning Tai Chi, whatever, and then all of a sudden, you literally just sort of noticed each other.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I think there was a seminar there. We did seminars where we would put on a show. People would, friends, family, whatever, would come and watch the Tai Chi demonstration. And my sister had come to the Tai Chi demonstration, and I was just sort of glancing over at Yvonne, and then my sister bumped me in the elbow, kind of like, what you doing? And then she's like, you should go.
You like her.
Yeah, right. Basically, my sister Wendy kind of called it out. She says, you should go talk to her. She's cute. And so I had approval from my sister. So
okay, she's in.
Yeah, right. It was just kind of a nudge in the right direction. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what started it, honestly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's very sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you still do Tai Chi?
Yes.
Funny
yes.
You should say that.
Yes.
Well, and isn't it kind of hard with a prosthesis?
Actually, I got much better at using my prosthesis after I learned Tai Chi. I actually learned Tai Chi in college first.
Okay.
And I took it because it was one of the few physical education classes I felt I could take. I tried doing low-impact aerobic exercise, like weightlifting and so forth, and I couldn't do a whole lot of aerobic machines because of my prosthetic leg. So I couldn't figure out what the next one I was going to do, because it was like basketball and all of this stuff I couldn't really do.
Yeah.
And so I saw Tai Chi, and my grandfather had always done Tai Chi, but he'd always done it in the bedroom with the door closed. So I always wondered, well, where did Grandpa go? And my mom said, he went to his bedroom to do Tai Chi. I'm like, really? What's he doing? He's like, he's doing Tai Chi.
I'm like,
I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, okay. You see pictures. There used to be videos of people doing things in the park or whatever.
Right.
So when I had this opportunity to take Tai Chi at college, I did. And the instructor there was really good. She gave me some really good foundations. But she realized it was hard for me to do Tai Chi, particularly when you have to stand on one leg at one point.
Right.
Especially my right one. And back then, I had a very 1940s prosthesis. It was they called it a satch foot. It basically was just a foam foot with a hard wood core in it. So it had no flexion in the ankle at all. And so she actually had one of her advanced instructors come in from New York, come to watch me. And he studied me, and we talked about it. And he said, you need to learn the sword eventually, because it'll help you project yourself out, because I think you can do it. And so actually I started to try to do this mental projection And I could actually stand on one foot, on the foot that was my artificial one, and everything worked out really well. So I was a real believer in Tai Chi for myself. It reduced
the confidence
pain.
That it would build.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of control, a lot of ability to walk smoothly and so forth. It smoothed out my gait a lot. There's been people who compliment me when we're walking in Stillwater, for example, and I'm in shorts, and a woman with another prosthetic limb saw me, and she shouted across the street. She's like, "You have the smoothest gait in the world."
Well, she noticed my gait. No one notices my gait.
And I said, "It's Tai Chi. And Tai Chi did it, because you have to be very conscious of it." So
I didn't know. Yvonne's very smooth, very good at Tai Chi. I didn't even know she had a prosthetic leg for a long time. The only thing I noted at some times is that her right ankle didn't move quite right, or I just my eye noticed it, but my brain didn't process that there was a prosthetic leg there. That's how, you know, smooth the Tai Chi was.
That would be kind of, yeah, like, when do you bring that up?
Yeah, it's yeah. Hard to bring up. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I actually forget that I hadn't brought it up, so I talk about it as if everyone knows. And my students actually said, "You know, you didn't tell us for the longest time that you had a prosthetic limb, but we heard this squeaking that sounded like farting, because the foot shell would go." And then I finally had to turn to them at one point. I said, "My leg is really making a lot of noise. It sounds like farts." And they're like looking at me. I'm like, "Oh, didn't I tell you that I have a prosthetic leg?" And I like lift up my leg, and they're like, "Oh, that makes lots more sense.
We thought you ate something weird."
I know. So I keep forgetting that I haven't told people, because when I was young, my mother had me in every single class that I had. I had to get up in front of the class and show them that I had a prosthetic limb, and tell them how I got it, why it happened, and all of those things. And it was interesting. It was because she wanted me to practice talking about it, but then she also wanted to make it so that there were no rumors, that people would just know right up front.
I see.
That it was there, and
yeah,
that they could openly talk to me about it.
Right, so it wasn't a secret or something
right.
You were trying to hide.
Right,
yeah,
right. And so then it became like, when I was like, I did stay in the same school for like probably 7 years, so I didn't have to do it. So it was hard for new people coming in, because they didn't know that I had a prosthetic leg.
Yeah.
And one of my friends, Alex, didn't know that I had a prosthetic leg senior year, and that was the year that I was doing a lot of swimming. He was in the swim team. He hung out at the pool. And I took my leg off then to swim.
Sure.
And I was swimming around in the pool, and he was sitting there hanging out, and he looked, he's like, "Oh, there's a leg here." And he's like, I wonder whose leg this is. And he kept looking. He's like, "No, they have two." And he saw, watched them as they got out, like, "They have two legs. They have two legs. They have two legs." He was like, "The only person left in the pool is Yvonne." And he was going to say, "Coach Kane, someone left their leg here." And then I came out and crawled across and said, "Hi, Alex, how are you?" And then I got my leg, and he's like, "Oh, Yvonne has an artificial leg." He's like, "I'm going to pretend like I already knew that." So, yeah, so a lot of people don't even – he knew me for 3 or 4 years in high school. For some reason, he never saw me in shorts, and he never saw that I'd taken my leg off. So he never knew.
Okay. So when did Troy know?
I don't remember
after that. Did you have a conversation about it, or –
I don't remember the exact time, but it just, at some point in Tai Chi class, either I heard her talking about it or just saw it. But at some point I
there wasn't a talk.
There wasn't a big talk.
No, I see.
At some point I became aware of it, but I don't remember.
And haven't you developed some things for your leg?
Troy wanted to go on a beach vacation. He said, "Wouldn't it be fun? We can go on the beach. We can go into the ocean. You can go scuba diving. We can go swimming." And I looked at him and I said, "Okay, like, first imagine sitting on the beach, and then you have to crawl across the hot sand to the ocean. And then now you're all wet, and you have to crawl back across the sand and hope that your leg hasn't been stolen, because you had to leave it there."
Yeah.
And then he goes, "Oh, well, let's just make you a new leg." And I'm like, "Oh, right. Legs don't grow on trees. They are made." So that started a very long saga of us trying to develop a swimming leg for me.
It was a very good engineering project. We've actually made 7 generations of the swim leg. And it kind of was every time we would go on a scuba diving vacation, we would try to make a – I would try to make it better. The first legs were horrible. They kind of worked but mostly didn't.
They're actually laughable now, aren't they?
No, they're laughable. But it got more and more advanced. We learned more and more about what was needed, how to, you know, you have to get on, off the dive boat, back on the dive boat, and worry about sand, you know, because sand is notorious for messing up mechanisms and, you know, chewing, binding things up. And so it had to be handling sand and salt water. You know, if you have one time I used a brass bushing next to aluminum and the galvanic reaction started and the brass just got chewed up chemically in almost no time. So we... By the
galvanic
salt water.
Reaction?
Basically a battery. I mean, just a chemical reaction. It started to oxidize.
I see.
Very rapidly.
Okay.
And yeah, with the salt water and the aluminum and the brass started to oxidize and basically bind up the mechanism in almost no time.
Oh,
so anyway, we had learned many things about what it would take to make it work. And we haven't been on the last scuba diving trip was when Kai was still not even born yet. It was 2 months.
He was a true glint in our eyes in that he was there.
let's just say he was going to be born in 7 months.
It was our baby moon. They call it our baby moon.
Right.
It was our honeymoon with a baby.
And we have found that there's a need out there. You know, other people, we put some videos on YouTube and other people contacted us, but it just, again, comes down to money. Insurance won't cover it. It's too much for people to pay out of pocket.
Why doesn't insurance cover it?
It's a sports prosthetic. They don't cover sports prosthetics. They cover, you know, your day-to-day, and they might even cover a shower leg, but they never cover sports.
What about people who live on the beach?
Doesn't
matter. It's out of pocket.
And it's out of pocket, yeah.
So we...
Gosh,
it's just economic. And there's also not enough. I mean, there's need out there, but not enough need.
Okay.
And so it's not really something that, you know, we could... like if we're wealthy and we wanted to be philanthropists, we could give this away free, and people would use it, but it just wasn't economically possible. So Yvonne's the only one who's ever worn our swim leg. There's others out there, but ours was specifically geared towards scuba diving and having to deal with 30 pounds of scuba diving gear and getting off the dive boat and jumping into the... So you have to walk across the dive boat.
It's a one-hand trigger. Other ones
look
you
at
have to, like,
you,
do
though.
That.
I mean, so adventurous.
Vaughn faced lots of challenges. Very courageous to go for it.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those where, because I have so many years with a prosthetic and I also have so much mechanical knowledge and body mechanics, because I have been interested in prosthetics for a long time. So all my anatomy knowledge that I had
since
I was five,
right.
I knew what was happening. And then... I have a very close relationship with my prosthetist, so he explained a lot of how prosthetics work. And so I was able to understand what I needed to have, and then being able to talk with Troy as an engineer to discuss the different aspects of what needed to happen. Plus, a leg can collapse on me, and I won't be in a lot of trouble, whereas someone who's less experienced in dealing with prosthetic limbs, a fall could totally scare them. I was actually walking up St. Kate's with a not Troy's, but we had a check socket, which is a very clear material, and it's not very strong. And I was walking with it, and right when I was walking up the art museum steps, it broke on me. Like,
oh no!
Literally broke off, and you couldn't hold it. It wasn't holding onto my leg properly. But because I know enough about how to flex my muscles, I could limp it along and get to the car and drive it home stick shift car and then get my actual leg, which apparently I'm like, they told me not to drive without my actual leg. But I was getting really adventurous. And so I can do these things because I've done it for – I'm very comfortable with knowing what I can do and what I can't do.
Sure.
I know my Sharon's probably going to be really upset that I did that, but it's already done.
That was a decade ago. So what are they going to do?
I have so much experience in driving and walking that I can take things that other people couldn't do a prototype with because it would be unsafe for them.
Yeah.
Can't wait to tell him. Kai is old enough so we can go on a scuba diving vacation again and break the scuba leg out.
Yeah.
No, need some miles on it.
Well, if you take him to swimming class, then yep, I'll be able to go swimming again. I do use it for swimming. And showering, I've never been able to shower in the locker room, and this allows me to shower in the locker room.
Oh, see, all these things.
I used to have to hop into the shower. That's what I would have to do.
What's dangerous? You could slip and fall.
It was dangerous, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I often would not shower, and I just showered at home. And that was, I mean, if we wanted to go out to eat afterwards, it was very uncomfortable and itchy and
covered in
chlorine.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I got two prostheses. I have two hips. I had hip surgery. That was my 50th birthday present to myself. The dilemma is in picking different parts for your hips. Mm-hmm. Like I have a hollowed out marble against the hardest plastic that they can make. If I had marble on marble, there'd be no wear. But there's like a pretty high percentage, like 80% or 20% chance that if you get the marble on marble, it'll squeak every time you walk. And so the next best thing was to do the plastic. But I was just thinking, wow, if you could resolve the marble issue, there's a huge market for that.
Yeah, artificial joints, that's a very, very, very challenging problem. I mean, there's only so many materials that exist, and there's only so many materials that you can actually implant in the human body.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very hard.
I mean, I was surprised, like marble? I mean, I've got marble in my body.
Yeah, it's a ceramic,
Yeah. We Mentor. The cool thing about what you were doing, I mean, to think, wow, I can actually help somebody, you know, do something they couldn't normally do.
We have a video of Ron jumping off a dock.
Yeah. Yeah. And then walking back out again.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's one of the things, like, you know, when Troy was talking last time, that things are never right the first time.
You
want to get iterative and you learn about it. We actually took the photographs of the different ones that we had, and I made that into a little video for the kids because I wanted to show them, you know, the design process is... You try something, you learn things, you figure out something else, and then you try the next one, and then you use that information to inform the next one, and then the next one, and the next one. And so our final version was the one, was that the one that we tested on our honeymoon?
The baby moon?
No, our real honeymoon. So we took a leg to our honeymoon.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there was one version, and then I think we had one more tweak on our baby moon.
I can't remember what version it was, but definitely the most... We just kept improving and improving it and learning about, you know, how to make it work. And I actually had to figure out how to make a prosthetic socket. The socket is what interfaces the leg to the person.
Oh, and sure.
Normally a prosthetist does that, but it's very, very expensive to get a custom socket made. So I had to kind of learn the technique because we couldn't afford, I mean, like $35,000 to get a socket made?
It's like, to get a new leg, it's the price of a small car.
Yeah.
Or a luxury car.
So I had to learn how to do it as part of the project because no way we could afford that.
And actually, we finally said, I had a new leg made, and I said, let's just use this socket. And so Troy just talked to our prosthetist about how to hook up to the existing leg. Mm-hmm. And they made it more modular so that a lot of other people could do the same thing because it's a standard Ottobock connection.
Yeah, we were trying to standardize more on what hardware that's used out in the world and techniques of how sockets are made.
Yeah.
So that ideally we wanted people to be able to bolt our swim foot on a standard leg, and they would have had to rig a release cable up to a leg. And that was kind of if anyone could ever use it, to make it possible is they could use a leg, because everyone has to get a new leg at least every, you know, 5 years at the most. Ideally every year.
Really?
Because your leg changes.
Yeah, I do it every 5 years.
And so they typically have an old leg that they could turn into a swim leg.
Oh, yeah,
that was the plan.
The cost, yeah.
So we use, you know, standard mounting hardware and adjustment hardware that on the most recent generation, most recent design.
And how accurate are companies or anyone that comes to you with a product that they want to develop, how accurate are they about the money that it would take to produce?
It always depends on their experience. We work sometimes with established companies that have used consultants in the past, and so they always have a pretty good idea.
Okay.
And sometimes we work with inventors, and you know, I kind of say to them, like, well, whatever amount is in your mind right now, you know, multiply by 4. Because
yeah,
it's okay. Like, even if you spent a long time thinking of everything, still double it, because you just can't think of everything. We have a product we're working on right now with an inventor, and he's been blown away about how hard it is.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. how much is involved and how much it costs and how much time it takes. He thought it would just be trivial. And it's been hard because the more explaining you have to do, the more, you know, expectations you have to manage, the more careful you have to be as a consultant.
Yeah.
Because it's easy if they have done it before and they kind of have thought a lot about what they want done. They come to you with a set of requirements. It's like, we want you to design this.
Yeah.
But when they come to you with a napkin, that's when you have to be very careful. Napkin sketch.
Yeah.
You know, just mm-hmm. sometimes even just an idea. I want a thingy that does this.
Right, right.
And so we have to be just more careful about what we do and make sure that they're informed along the way.
I was once worked with a woman who was Jewish and wanted the Jewish alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet, mm-hmm. on a mat that you could put on their tray, mm-hmm. her infant's tray, to learn the alphabet. I mean, we went through so many drafts. And then, you know, the high chairs, the tops of them, they're all different. You know, there's no standard size.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
There's the standardization is another. If you want it on everything, then you have to think about that as a criteria.
Yeah, right. Design. Yeah, right. So we looked at, you know, so I was just... I was like, wow, okay, yeah. And that was, you know, it was her napkin idea.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, well, let's take it through. Let's explore this a little bit and talk to a few manufacturers, of plastic manufacturers, and see what they think and then see where we go from there.
Sure.
But yeah, she just, after the fourth or fifth, and it was just 4 or 5 times, you know, that she went through a different design that she just realized, yeah, this isn't worth it for her. Her child would be too old by the time she finishes.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because like the toys that I've helped to design or the toy concepts I designed with Kai when he was a certain age. And then when I brought it to Mindware, the local toy company here that has now made one and is going to be coming up with another one in August. By the time they come out, Kai will never be able to use them because he's like too old for it.
Yeah, right.
But it's just like, well, he gets the prototype, the one that I made, and then other kids get the other ones. But it's true. It just takes that amount of time. And I think that's like what Troy says. People have such, they think things are going to be just so quick.
Right.
You know? And if you think about it, you know, we've been in college and teaching students. Students don't write papers the first time. Like, you have to do a draft. And especially if you're writing for someone else, you write a draft and they go, well, that's not what I wanted, or you don't have that right.
Yeah,
you have to plan on a few iterations.
Mm-hmm.
That's just words. Now imagine that you have to now work within the laws of physics and the physical realities. That's another level of complication.
Yeah.
That's going to require another set of iterations.
So, yeah.
Like, I always told the students when I talked to Troy about his engineering experience, we came up with the rule of, plan, it's never one and done, because that's the worst possible one that you could make. And even if it looked perfect, you can always improve it. So plan on 3 to 5 times. If you get into 7 to 10, you're just randomly guessing. So you have to kind of stick within that window of 3 to 5.
Oh, that's a good framework to think about it.
Right, because I deal with a lot of elementary teachers, so first graders, and they said, oh, I want to encourage them to try again. I said, yeah, but they want to try something, get some information from the previous one, and then do a new iteration based off of that. Not, well, that didn't work, and throw everything out and start
from like the baby withdrawal, the baby with the bathwater type idea.
But a first grader, that's the mental stage. I mean, I've worked with...
Oh, forget this. Yeah, let's just start over.
Yeah. And so So they have to, I said, you can help them develop this more informed iterative process in there. And that's what an engineering consultant does for you.
Yeah.
They get it to the point where they actually know what they're gleaning out of that prototype so that that's a very strong second iteration.
Yeah.
And then a very strong third iteration, and then you're done, if you're lucky. Sometimes there's two more.
Yeah. That's excellent. Well, all of our listeners, I'll have both of your websites on the narrative that I write for our sessions. But for sure, everyone teaching STEM should really check out your website, the Engineers Playground. I mean, you've got your books, you've got so many excellent content that you're always writing about on there.
I try to work with content. And then I also have a Pinterest for resources that I find that are interesting. I don't have tons of them, but because I want to vet each one of them out as I go through. And I try to find things that are missing. There's a lot of really good STEM information out there, but I kind of pick these like odd ones that I see as an engineer. And I'm like, those are good.
Yeah.
That they're really getting to some interesting aspects that maybe a typical STEM elementary education teacher won't recognize as valuable.
Oh, sure. So, is there anything else that you would like to comment on? Time, you know, usually just goes so fast once we get started.
Well, what are we talking about? I mean, what in particular?
I know, because we've been talking about, with every guest, I mean, it's interesting for me, and I really like to give a full background about entrepreneurs. I just think that what we do seems to be like this mystery. And I think that there's conversations like this where we're full people and we're trying to do some really incredible things to improve our world. Mm-hmm. And so talking about a wide range of things, our background, how we ended up where we at, you know, how are we approaching different problems in society, and how you two have come together. I just think it's a beautiful story.
Well, I know one thing that you had asked, and I'm trying to make this really brief, was how we had to make certain decisions about our relationship, being married and then also having a small child.
Mm-hmm.
And I know one of the things that we've tried to do to help make that successful is Troy had worked out of the house for a while, and then I had helped him set up his business accounting and more formal structures. And then what we found out is that working with your spouse in your house with a small child, sounds like a Dr. Seuss thing,
right,
is not a good idea because it's like way too much together time.
And so, yeah.
So when I took the job, it was to get me out of the house. And they always said, oh, you could work from home first. I said, I don't need to work out from my home. I have far
Take that off
too
my,
much yeah. together time with my husband. But now that he's not, you know, there anymore, it's possibly a possibility. But the flexibility of one of us being able to back up the other one in case Kai gets sick or something like that has been important for both of us.
You know, once Kai gets older too, I think your perspectives also will shift because your parenting role shifts. Mm-hmm. And so that might be something you can approach too. I just think you two are really good together with how you think about things. And
it's not effortless. I mean, there's definitely some, you know, arguing, some...
I think we've argued
discussion.
More since having Kai than we ever did before.
Well, there was a massive shift.
I think
shift
every
when Kai was born.
Couple.
Yep.
Right?
Say that.
Yeah.
The child is the one that really
Mike,
makes it a challenge.
The sound engineer over here, photographer. Yeah, he's nodding.
He's nodding. Yeah.
You know, kids change the dimension of a relationship.
Yeah.
And even if it's a really solid, great relationship, you're just, you know, in a different role.
Yeah. There are different parameters that you have to deal with that you didn't before.
And the longer you wait to have kids, I mean, you kind of, I think it's a bigger, I found it to be a bigger transition in lifestyle because I really liked my other lifestyle, you know, and I love having, and I've got one child too.
Yep.
She's 15 now.
Okay.
It's just a different dimension. And Mike has four boys.
I applaud you.
Yes. Wow. Yeah, Kai, I don't know, man. He takes all of our time. I don't know what we'd do.
I don't even know.
We had more kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a massive adjustment for me. You know, I was so used to having time away for flying or for mountain biking, for all these sports I used to do, and just the biggest thing is time.
Yeah.
I thought I was busy before. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, right.
And now I know what busy is, and that's with one kid. And I can't even conceive of 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can play for hours. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you brought that up because I think everyone who is in a relationship with someone who's entrepreneurial, or if they both are, or I mean, it's a lot of different things to work out and a lot of different conversations. I'm not surprised that you would be arguing a little bit more because there's also different parenting styles. Mm-hmm. And you're all focused on this one, you know, child to raise them in a certain way and how you're using your time. And
I think fortunately our parenting styles or values are pretty close.
Oh, okay. That does help.
I think.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
think so. We want to have the same kind of characteristics in the kid coming out and as a firmness. I think I'm the stronger hand because I come from a Chinese background.
I mean, I think when Kai was younger, Yvonne would attempt to use more words and I would just grab him, you know, pick him up.
Yeah, right.
I had this trick of when Kai was to reset his brain. For some reason, I figured out if I picked him up and held him upside down, he would just start laughing and would just reset the brain. You know, and
I would not have done that. Yeah, I
mean, it wasn't, you know, rough or anyway, but it,
yeah,
whatever he was fixated on before, he suddenly wasn't fixated on anymore.
Right.
You know, like, I want a treat, I want a treat, I want a treat, I want some candy upside down. What was I thinking about? You know, so that was,
oh, my world looks different.
Yeah, so that's one of my parenting skills.
Oh, that is really clever.
But he seemed to like it. He still does. He's like, I want to go upside down. And so I'll just carry him upside down to his bedroom. He still likes it.
Yeah. Who knew, right?
Yeah, right?
You were just trying to solve the problem.
Or, I don't know. Kai's, I think he's more physical with me. Like, I'll be just laying there, and all of a sudden he'll launch across the room and then just leap into the air and land on me. Oh. I'll be like, oh! And he just laughs. Or I don't think he'll do that with you as much.
Yeah, well, I usually have a discussion with him about how I think I use a lot of physics terms. Like, higher velocity, greater impact, hurts more, stop doing it. This kid is going to know a lot of physics terms by the time we're done. I was washing dishes with him when he was like one, and I was telling him about different materials. And now, what is he talking about? Materials.
Is he?
He's trying to figure out. He's like, you know what never breaks, Mommy? And I said, what? Metal. I said, oh, no, we can break metal.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you know what always breaks is plastic. I said, not always. So he's going through all the materials.
Oh, that's cool.
What he can break and what he can't break.
When I was a kid, mine was always to figure out the limit of when it would break. One time my father handed me a 3-inch bore bearing that came out of like a tractor or a very heavy machine.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah.
I mean, it probably had a total diameter of 4-inch and like 3/4-inch width. And he's like, try to break that. And he just kind of laughed because he knew, or he thought, it was impossible. But somehow I had it on the floor in just the right angle and I wailed on it with a hammer and actually fractured a shard of metal out of it. And I go, Dad, I broke it. And I just remember he looked at me just like, what the? He just shook his head and then he held his hands in his head and he says, what is going on here?
Little did he know this but would be really helpful later in life.
It actually was. Interacting, you know, with materials and figuring out how they break, that people make their living doing that. You know, they call them a material scientist. All they do is figure out how strong stuff is and at what point it will break and then record those values to characterize materials. But I was doing it kind of more hands-on approach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But yeah, you definitely learn. Okay, you know, wood behaves this way, plastic this way, steel this way, glass this way.
And that's always been very informative in when I give suggestions to teachers because we talk about giving the kids things that they can just break, that they can take apart, that it's already broken.
So yeah.
They already can do that and get a sense of what the materials are like and just allow that play to happen a little bit more. Because we kind of try to short circuit kids a lot, tell them things.
Tell them. And like,
and that's the biggest thing that I've had to do as an educator is to not tell Kai anything. I mean, if he asks a question or if he kind of looks or I point out certain things that might clue him in, but Troy and I have talked about that because I watch him very carefully and how his pantering style is regarding that. And he lets him just do a lot of playing on his own. And
yeah.
It's where you learn a lot of the stuff. And if you deny them that ability, you've short-circuited their curiosity. You've short-circuited their persistence. You've short-circuited their observation skills. You just have to let them. And they may break things. That's the other thing. He's playing with some gears, motorized gears, and I hear this, and I'm like, you see these three gears are grinding. Troy's like, just let him figure it out. If he breaks it, he breaks it. It's his toy.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, you're right. I really don't want to break it because I have toys from when I was a kid because I preserved them. And he's like, don't assume that's going to happen. He's like, and he will learn something from everything that he breaks.
Yeah.
So.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Lots of learning going on there, both in your household and at both of your work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of innovation happening and restructuring and changing things. And
apparently everything has to be turned over at some point, right? Turn over the apple cart and learn something new.
That's right. So. Yeah, that's why I started the named the dual innovation journey. Is looking at, you know, the effect of your innovation with your business, what it has on you, also in your relationships and how you're leading, and how that shifts at different times. And when you're doing the innovation, you're figuring out the cash flow and everything. And so going through the process is not just about the business or the new element that you're innovating. It's really about your process with that. Along with it. And that's why, like, you know, your relationships change through the process of how your business changes because your perspective shifts. And so we never really talk about that enough, I think.
Well, I know when Troy started the company, he said, and I know you have to stop now, but I had told him at one point, I said, if you're unhappy at your job, you have to promise that you will try to figure out what you will be happy with. Because my father was very unhappy in one of his job, in some of his jobs.
Yeah.
And he made the rest of us miserable in the family.
Yeah, right. It's so connected.
And I said, we will figure out something, but it's important for you to enjoy what you're doing.
Yeah, the happy factor.
Mm-hmm. And I could speak to like what you say, how you're perspective shifts.
Yeah.
I can remember when I first started consulting, I was very happy to be just by myself.
Yeah.
You know, that I could do whatever. And, well, for example, like when I was waiting for some files to upload after I had finished them, I flew remote control helicopters around the office because there's no one else there.
Yeah.
I didn't have to worry about crashing to anyone. But after about you know, 6 years, 5 years, I hired interns. And then I kind of reached this point where I wanted people around or needed help because the business grew. And so the perspective, you have to make this decision, you know, are you going to hire people or are you going to stay a one-man shop? Because I've seen people choose that. I've seen people say they're happy with being a one-person shop and they stay that way forever. I've seen people build up some employees and just figure out that they were happier when they were, you know, by themselves because they weren't making more money. It was just headaches. And they're like, I'm just going to go back to one-man shop. But I made a decision that I didn't want to do it all by myself, that I wanted people around. I wanted help. And then around the 10 and 11-year mark, the perspective kind of changed again. I decided I didn't want. There were between three and four employees at the time.
Yeah.
And I kind of said, I don't want the next 10 years to be like the last 10 years. So that's when I started to kind of talk to people or cast about or let one of the business partners, Rod Landers, that he's electrical. And he says, and you know, this is a perfect marriage, electrical, mechanical, you know, when you design things. And he says, well, if you want to get in he had a business that he built up and then sold, and he was not quite sure what to do next. He kind of tried a couple different things for 4 years, but then I said, if you want to get in the consulting game again or partner up together, let me know. And then at first he couldn't because he was under contract to not compete with the company, you know, that he sold. But after the three-year mark was up, he had enough time to figure out that he was happiest doing that.
Oh.
And so then he called me up and he said, also, I'm talking to another guy that's software. And so it was actually, I was hoping for just an electrical partner.
Yeah.
But it actually turned out that it was electrical, you know, software and mechanical all in one place, which is Lab 651. So yeah, there's quite a perspective shift.
Yeah.
There's no way I was ready to enter a partnership right at the beginning.
Yeah.
Or take on employees. It kind of evolved over time and decisions about which way to go.
Yeah.
So yeah, it did change, definitely changed over time. It wasn't static. I started consulting in 2005, and it has been quite a bit of change. I think an analogy I heard once is you know, water is trickling down a hill. It starts to fill up a pool. The water won't go down the rest of the way down the hill until that full pool fills up. And that pool will, you know, then fill up and spill in the next pool. And then that pool will fill up and then into the next. It was kind of like that.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah.
Changing perspective.
Mm. Beautiful.
But yeah. That's, well, just the way it happened.
Yeah, right. Well, and it doesn't happen without kind of the process of talking about it and figuring it out. And what will make me happy
is
kind of a nice part of the journey. Mm-hmm. And what did make me happy for a while, I can't sustain it any longer. Mm-hmm. And so making those changes are really critical to your own well-being and to everybody else's. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being here. I just think we could just go on for hours. I would love to have you come back at a different time. I'll maybe check in next year and we'll see what happens.
Sure.
Certainly.
Yeah. Great. All right.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Yvonne. Thanks, Troy.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah. Sound engineer, photographer. We'll show the great pictures we're about to take. Okay. And see everybody next Monday.